Hi and welcome to Axel Bank Reports History and Today, conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. I'm Evan Axelbank, and today we're going to speak with Andrew Rice, the author of The Year That Broke America, An Immigration Crisis, A Terrorist Conspiracy, The Summer of Survivor, A Ridiculous Fake Billionaire, A Fight for Florida, and The 537 Votes That Changed Everything. This is his second book, and he is an editor at New York Magazine. Thanks so much for being here, Andrew.
Thanks for having me on.
Before we start our interview, I want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping the show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity for children's literacy. There was a pervasive idea that once we got to the year 2000, everything would be different. Flying cars, meals in pill form, and the world would sing kumbaya because we just made it to the future. 2000 is such a big round number, especially when it takes so long to get there. It just felt like we were on the verge of something special. Andrew Rice argues that things did change in the year 2000, but not in the way we had hoped. Instead, he argues we can look back on that year as the one that launched forces that would lead to the seemingly irreparable feel of our politics and our trust. First of all, Andrew, does that number 2000, does the number matter in this case? Or is it just a coincidence that so many important things happened that year?
I say in the first chapter of the book, you know, that the history seldom pays heed to round numbers. But in this specific case, I think that you can make the argument that the year 2000 was tectonically significant. Not really in the ways that people expected it to be, but in unexpected ways. I think that, you know, you can't say that the departure point that occurred in 2000 happened specifically because it was that year. It wasn't specifically that the millennium year was galvanizing or created any of these things. But what I think is true is that was this moment that happened to mark the sort of confluence of a lot of different underlying trends that were going on, you know, in the culture, in politics, that ultimately ended up creating this departure point as I say, it was the year that broke America. And you can talk about a lot of different ways in which things broke that year that have never really been fully fixed.
So first of all, what were the 1990s like? Take us back to the 1990s, and how had the millennium been teed up by those of us who lived through that time?
Well, I mean, you know, as I say in the book, I mean, you know, it was at this moment in December 1999, this time of the millennium of the Y2K, the Y2K period that many of your readers may at least be familiar, or what many of your listeners may be at least familiar with in a kind of historical way, if they didn't necessarily live through it. It was this time of great expectation. And part of the expectation was built on the around the idea that it was a high point in U.S. history, possibly in world history. I mean, I don't think that there was a period really in which the world was as much at peace as it was during the late 1990s. It was a period of great prosperity. That was a period in which the power of Russia, in particular, which of course was the dominating superpower adversary of the United States for most of the second half of the 20th century, that the power of Russia was at a low ebb. And in fact, you know, at that time, it was considered likely that in the future, the United States and Russia would proceed as sort of friends, or at the very least as collaborators in this new global order built around lower lower trade barriers, more intercultural communication, and a kind of coming together of peoples that was really typified by a lot of the celebrations around the millennium. It was also the year in which there were, China, was brought into the World Trade Organization, really a moment in which China's position as a global economic power was validated, and the way was really paved for a lot of, what we saw in subsequent generations in terms of rising Chinese economic power. Now, to the point about, what was going on underneath the surface, there's also a time of incredible large anti-globalization protests, some of them surrounding the accession of China to the WTO. This idea that that somehow the United States was making deals that were not good for U.S. interests. This was something that was bubbling up from underneath. It was bubbling up both on the left and the right.
And there was also an impeachment of a president. I mean, that was a very divisive time, and it really made people very emotional about American politics. It's not like that all started with Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, although, I make the case in the book that, there was an impeachment over a sex scandal that took place in the White House, the Lewinsky scandal, which, I think everybody is familiar with. The stakes of politics seemed incredibly low during this time period, as opposed to having impeachment scandals or presidential elections that seemed almost existential in the stakes. This idea that, in the present day, we have this idea that, in every election, it seems as if, democracy itself might be on the line. At that time, it was popular to say that there was really no difference between the two political parties, that the politics was sort of just this game, this low stakes game that was mostly about personality, personal foibles, character, and so on. And so therefore, in that context, the Lewinsky scandal was a really big deal, but it was a really big deal because it was a kind of, a soap opera twist to a soap opera presidency and a soap opera era.
In writing this book, did you have to, and or did you at least research the history of the future, the history of what people expected would be coming, and what did people assume the year 2000 and after would be like?
I did actually do some amount of that. I mean, one of my preliminary titles for the book was going to be In the Year 2000. This was when I made my book proposal. That was like what it was titled. And that was taken from a Conan O'Brien sketch that was frequently, on late night TV, where he kind of lampooned this idea that, in the year 2000, all sorts of, futuristic things would transpire. Certainly from the turn of the 20th century on, people have been looking forward to this time and this idea that, 2000 was this faraway point at which, people would say in 2000, we'll definitely have cancer cured by the year 2000, or people would say, well, we'll definitely be living on Mars by the year 2000. This would be the notions of, it would be just this, as this sort of mile marker somewhere in the distant enough future that you can make these predictions without much accountability. Well, by the time the year 2000 actually rolled around and flying cars hadn't materialized, people started to laugh about the idea that all these predictions about what the world would look like in the year 2000. Partly I did do a lot of research into that. I also, though, looked at, I referenced Y2K earlier. I also looked at the you know, the apocalyptic predictions about the year 2000. So a lot of people made predictions that, you know, technology would advance or what have you, by the year 2000. But a lot of people also, many of them religious, but not all, made these predictions that there would be a disaster in 2000, that there would be an apocalyptic event in 2000. And the most famous you know, manifestation of this was this Y2K bug, which was a computer bug that based on early computer programming and the way that the dates were programmed into the into computers, there was this idea that that there would be a massive computer malfunctions at the stroke of midnight on 2000 that would cause, you know, in the most extreme sort of versions of this this doomsaying prophecy, you know, there would be nuclear exchanges or planes would fall out of the sky. A lot of people were genuinely very scared about it. A lot of survivalists started socking up for it, and I write a lot about this this ferment, especially on the far right, around the idea that that technology itself would kind of would malfunction in the year 2000. And as I say in the book, ultimately, you know, technology did end up malfunctioning, but just in ways that they didn't necessarily expect. Like, for instance, you know, resulting in the incorrect prediction of the presidential winner on election night.
Which we can get to in a second. But reading your book, it gave me such a kick to see how many of different events that at the time were seemingly unrelated turned out to be coming together in the year 2000 in ways that I didn't realize at the time. It was fascinating. Two of the big threads that you followed were the election of 2000 between Bush and Gore, and then the plotting of 9/11. One of them was something that we did to ourselves, meaning the election, and the other was something done to us, meaning 9/11. How did you realize that they could no longer be viewed as separate events?
Well, I think that I can't, I mean, I can't claim that I'm the first person to have come to this realization. I think in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, there was a widespread recognition that there was something, at the very least, historically eerie about the fact that at the same time the election was being decided in Florida by the narrowest of margins, 537 votes for the for those of those listeners of yours who don't necessarily recall the exact circumstances. You know, the entire election came down to Florida, separated by a tiny, tiny, minuscule number of votes in Florida, and created a, you know, huge loss litigation mess that ended up in the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, you know, while all this stuff was happening in Florida, and Florida was because was the kind of fulcrum or focus of the entire political world's attention, the guys who were plotting to truly change the world for the worse, were there in Florida training, learning to fly, and often oftentimes even crossing paths with the presidential contender. Certainly they were aware of and observing the what was going on in Florida as it happened. They were pretty attuned to politics, as you might imagine. And so this was something that I wasn't the only one to notice. There was a lot of people remarked at the time, like, there's something crazy going on in Florida in 2000, but it was somewhat forgotten in the decades that followed. I mean, a lot of other things happened. But if you watch the opening sequence, for instance, of Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore's anti-Iraq documentary, anti-Iraq war documentary, it starts with Florida. It starts with the recount. It situates the Bush administration in this kind of, you know, original legitimacy sin that Michael Moore isolated. And of course, he's a political polemicist, but nonetheless, I think it just goes to show that this is something that was very much on people's minds, this confluence of events at the time.
And I couldn't believe it, but there were times where, like, Bush would be landing at an airport and the plotters were learning to fly at the same airport at the same exact time. And you even said you wonder if they considered an assassination attempt right then and there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was about as far as I could get into the realm of speculation, right, in terms of trying to think of, you know, what the mindset of these individuals might have been. But what we definitely do know for a fact is that they were training at the Sarasota airport at a time when Bush came in for a rally at the airport. It was happened right in front of the flight school. A couple of weeks later, Al Gore flew in for his debate preparation, spent an extensive amount of time. Actually, his Air Force Two was parked at the airport the entire weekend, at the same time that Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, two of the key plotters in 9/11, were there at that airport. And I talked with one of their flight instructors, and he remembered well, you know, the Secret Service was swarming everywhere, and you know that the plane was parked at the gate at the flight school. So they had this, but you know, more broadly beyond the kind of just the physical, you know, coincidence of their happening to be at the same place at the same time. What I think is interesting is that they were able to see and observe the presidential election and the dysfunction of American society and the kind of unseriousness with which both parties really approached this whole thing. They saw all of that firsthand. And I can't help but think that it must have in some way informed their pre-existing, reinforced their pre-existing impression that the United States was a sort of a fat, happy, complacent, easy target, because we were really fighting over extremely minor things when major things were really brewing right there on the home front.
Back in the year 2000, this name was a name that you could not avoid. It was simply everywhere. And today, his name is, essentially a part of history at this point. You almost never hear the name Elian Gonzalez anymore. But in the year 2000, I mean, as a teenager, you couldn't get away from it. And there were stories every night on the evening news. I did not remember, or maybe I didn't realize at the time, what an impact this standoff had over his immigration status, this standoff had on the election itself. So if you can, introduce us to Elian Gonzalez and explain how it became the ultimate political football in the ultimate battleground state.
Well, I mean, it is both a touching human story and a dismaying political story. Basically what happened was in Thanksgiving of 1999, a small boat set out from Cuba trying to escape Castro's dictatorship. The boat foundered, and only a handful of people on board survived, one of them being this 5-year-old boy. He was brought ashore, and under the prevailing legal practices of the time, he was put on a fast track for citizenship as a Cuban citizen. He was given to, because his mother was one of the people who died on the boat, he was given to some relatives to stay with. And this is where things got complicated, because it turned out that Elian's father didn't know that he was going to be on this boat, didn't approve of his wife's plan his ex-wife's plan to take his son to the United States, and said very clearly he wanted his son back. So this sparked this really, really long and involved emotional fight between a group of Cuban exiles living in Miami, who were backed by the entirety of the Cuban population in Miami, which is incredibly influential within the Republican Party, both in Florida and nationally, against the father, who got support from the attorney general at the time, Janet Reno, who was herself a Miami native.
I felt so bad for Janet Reno in the middle of reading your book. What a tough position to be in.
And an extraordinary person, and a certain, when you talk about Elian Gonzalez being a forgotten historical figure, I mean, Janet Reno just was the first female attorney general, but also just somebody who was such an amazing character. So somebody who's very much like of South Florida and part of this, you know, somebody who really like knew this place. And the irony of it is that, you know, she knew this place, Miami, better than anybody else. And yet she wandered into this swamp of political dissent and fighting over this child. So basically for months, this went back and forth. What would be the fate of this child? Would he be handed over to the family in Cuba? Most Americans, polls showed, said, yes, his father, you know, has the rights to take him back to Cuba. But in Miami, overwhelmingly, people felt, especially people of Cuban descent, felt that the boy should be allowed to live in the United States, allowed to have freedom. And, you know, George W. Bush embraced this cause. The Republican Party at large embraced this cause. Ultimately, Janet Reno, after much, 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 much negotiation, decided that the only thing left to do was to actually send in armed Border Patrol agents into this house in Miami that Elian was staying at with his extended relatives. They raided the house in, you know, a handful of minutes, pulled out the kid, put him on a plane back to Washington, and after some more legal stuff, he ended up back in Cuba by June of 2000. Now, the whole thing was captured in this indelible photo that you know, if people remember one thing about the Elian Gonzalez controversy, they remember this photo, which is of a Border Patrol agent with a gun coming to take Elian Gonzalez away from a person who was holding him inside a closet. And that photo became, won a Pulitzer Prize, became an indelible kind of image that the Cuban population of Miami really rallied around. And in November, they turned out in huge numbers, overwhelmingly for George W. Bush, creating a giant swell of support in South Florida for the Republicans, which clearly became the deciding factor in the election, probably more so than any other single factor in Florida.
Even more than Buchanan getting all those votes in Palm Beach County, even more than African-American voters turned away from the voting rolls.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're referring to a couple of instances of balloting irregularity. There were problems, you know, just to jump ahead in 2000 with basically things that maybe sound a little bit familiar today to our listeners, albeit from another political context. There were a presidential candidate supporters claiming that people had cast ballots incorrectly. There were questions about whether there had been voter fraud. There were questions about whether there had been voter suppression of Black voters. Of course, the positions were reversed, and it was the Democrats who were making the claims that the winner of the election was illegitimate. But to your question, I think that clearly that the many, many tens of thousands of votes in South Florida, if you look at the difference between Gore's performance in South Florida in 2000 and Clinton's reelection campaign performance in South Florida in 1996, it's a matter of a couple hundred thousand votes at least that swung to the Republicans. And a lot of that is, I think, attributable to anger over Elian.
Your book has this marvelous little cover here. I'm not sure who designed it, but it's a really wonderful cover. It's got Bill and Hillary. I got it right here. Yeah. It's Bill and Hillary Clinton on the cover with Janet Reno and Jesse Jackson and some other key players in the 2000 saga that you chronicled: George W. Bush, Al Gore, Elian Gonzalez on his inner tube, floating. And then right in the middle of it is Donald Trump. I guess in the swamp of my teenage years, I didn't quite realize that he actually did run for president in 2000 and at least toyed with it very significantly. It was a nascent campaign. Clearly, it was something that was in his head. He thought it might be possible. why didn't it work that time? Was it that the country wasn't ready for him, or that he wasn't ready for the country?
Well, it was a combination of things. I mean, first of all, I mean, what's shocking to the modern day person reading about the Trump campaign of 2000 is how unchanged he is.
He basically
ran for president. The guy never evolves, right? He ran for president exactly the same way in 2000 that he ultimately run for president in 2016. He threw bombs at people. He insulted John McCain, and said that he liked war heroes who weren't captured. John McCain was running for president that year as a Republican in the primary campaign, actually as a Republican reformist in the primary campaigns. He called all sorts of people all sorts of names. The thing that was different, and I think there are two things that are different. One was, I think you could say in both cases, you can say that Donald Trump lacked a platform. He lacked a platform, a political platform, in the sense that he didn't really have anything to say. His basic campaign, he ran for the nomination of the Reform Party, which is a third party that had performed quite well in the previous two elections. But other than sort of notionally saying that he wanted to reform Washington by getting rid of all those other people who were currently in an office, he didn't really have anything to say. You know, he also didn't have a platform in the sense of a way to speak to the public. He didn't have Twitter. He didn't have social media. The way he communicated with the public at that time was mostly via the press. And the press kind of, he had to strike a kind of a humiliating bargain with the press in order to get their attention, which was, you know, that they would cover him, but only on the condition that they could make fun of him constantly. So basically, you know, his entire campaign was covered as this joke. It was considered ridiculous. He went on Jay Leno, and, you know, Leno played Hail to the Chief, and they, you know, yucked it up about, you know, how you know, ridiculous it was that Donald Trump thought that he could be president. But I think that there is like one, you know, this would all be sort of just a little bit of a historical blip or footnote if it weren't for, you know, something that's very important, which was, you know, when I mentioned the political platform earlier, the person that Donald Trump ran against, Pat Buchanan, who was the other most formidable, there are several other people who campaigned for that nomination, but Pat Buchanan was the most formidable and ultimately ended up getting the nomination. Pat Buchanan campaigned on a platform of, you know, build a wall. He wanted to tear up trade agreements with China. He campaigned as a populist. They called him Pitchfork Pat Buchanan, and he gathered support from a lot of the people that we would now think of as Trumpers. And so what Donald Trump learned from that campaign, I think, was not just that he had to have a way to speak to people, but that he had to have a message. And, you know, whether you consider it fortunate or unfortunate, the message that he ultimately settled upon as his message was Pat Buchanan's. He took Pat Buchanan's platform and pretty much wholesale and ran on it himself in 16 years with, far greater success.
What was pop culture like in the year 2000? I mean, I'm thinking back to it, and you got Seinfeld was, you know, kind of emblematic of the 1990s. The show Friends was on. Boy bands had kind of taken over pop music. You look back and it certainly feels like we were living through this sort of, as you put it a little earlier, like this lack of urgency. Like we could just kind of listen to our music and watch our show about people not really doing much with their lives and kind of, you know, go on to the next thing. You argue that Survivor sort of came to be emblematic of the summer, and that this idea of competition and of going it alone sort of became new and became something that became ingrained into our culture, that back then it wasn't necessarily, you know, no one really had seen a TV show like this before. Now it's like every TV show is a reality show. How did that break America, the pop culture?
Well, I think that actually, like, even more so than the competitive aspect of Survivor, I think, you know, the salient part for the future was the idea that, you know, when you say that all TV is reality TV now, I mean, it's like not only is all TV reality TV, but just like everything is reality TV now. And I think that the, you know, that includes politics, that includes, you know, our social media lives, that includes, you know, the biggest merger in modern, you know, technology company history in the form of Elon Musk's bid to buy Twitter. All of these things sort of seem torn from a reality TV kind of playbook, and we live in a reality TV kind of world. And that all began with Survivor. I actually also say, in addition to beginning with Survivor, I think actually the Ellie and Gonzalez controversy laid the groundwork in many ways for our modern news media culture. You know, the Ellie and Gonzalez controversy was very much a news event. There have been these big news events that were totally that were kind of transfixing, to the culture in the past before, of course, like the Lewinsky scandal being an example, the O.J. Simpson trial being an example. But the Ellie and Gonzalez controversy was really a case in which, you know, people who were not famous previously ended up becoming famous for, you know, a very random kind of reason, and suddenly ended up becoming these celebrities with celebrity power and also with political power, you know, almost overnight. This was a sort of new form of fame born out of the fact that there were sort of these new cable TV networks that had unlimited hours to fill, and they were discovering that these sort of small bore dramas, if properly packaged, could end up yielding entertainment. Mark Burnett, the creator of Survivor, was discovering the same thing, you know, on the entertainment side of the ledger, which is basically he said, if we can take a television game show and turn it in and make it more like a, you know, almost like more like a news event, make it more like an event that's sort of filmed in real time, where there's some real kind of tension as to, you know, the relationships between the characters and the politics between the characters, and we turn all of that into a drama, maybe we could make some television entertainment that people want to watch. And, you know, he was awarded, you know, fantastically for that. You know, ultimately, of course, Mark Burnett ends up to go on. His next big project was this program he came up with the idea for around the year 2000 called The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which was supposed to be Survivor in the world of business. And I know
someone who would be a great host for that show.
Well, he needed a host, right? So his big problem that he writes in his book was that he needed to find the right person to host it. And it wasn't until he met Donald Trump some years later at an event for Woolman Rink. I think one of his shows used Woolman Rink, and Donald Trump was there, and they kind of got to talking about this project, and you know, the rest is sort of history.
So where do the breakages start to happen? How does America start to be broken? And I would just kick it off this way. You know, the popular vote winner was not declared to be the winner of the presidency, because the Electoral College went for George W. Bush, even though Al Gore had won the popular vote by 500,000 votes. And you say that this was the last time that this was the first time that has become a consecutive sort of streak here, that the president has not been considered legitimate by members of the other party. So, you know, George W. Bush was viewed by some Democrats, or many Democrats, as being illegitimate. Barack Obama, because of Donald Trump and the birther conspiracy, was viewed as being illegitimate. And then Donald Trump himself over Russia, and then Joe Biden because of Donald Trump, and the claims that he made about the quote unquote stolen election, which of course is not true. So the breakages are significant there. And you argued that that was a really big one, that after that election, our politics was irretrievably broken because the president was never deemed the president of everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I think our politics may not be, I hope it's not irretrievably broken, but like we are caught in this recursive loop in which each, you know, party denies the legitimacy of the other party. And a lot of that, or the other party's president, and a lot of that does trace back to 2000. And specifically, you know, if you ask, like, when did it start to be broken? You know, I think I really, you know, make the case in the book that divergence takes place on, you know, on the election night of 2000. And the description of election night takes up an entire chapter in my book. And I don't have time to get into all of it, but basically.
So good, by the way, you did an incredibly good job with it.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, basically it was this event where, you know, anyone who lived through it will never forget it, because no election night had ever felt like that before. Now it sort of seems like almost every election night sort of feels the same way, but the 2000 one did. But at the time, it was this feeling of kind of like almost watching a car crash happen, where you just can't. When you're in a car crash, when it's happening, you think to yourself, like, I can't believe this is actually happening. It's all happening in slow motion. Of course, that night, it started off with Al Gore was declared the president, he was declared the winner in Florida, which effectively meant he would be the next president by all the networks. So, you know, for a couple of hours, Democrats thought that Al Gore was going to be president. A little while later, they discovered some problems with their computer models, and the network said, oops, actually, we don't know who won Florida.
And they were in the World Trade Center, by the way.
Yeah.
People doing the counting had an office in there.
So they were on the not just in the World Trade Center, they're at the top of the world of two World Trade Center. One World Trade Center, the North Tower of the World Trade Center on the 93rd floor. And they were busily working at their analog computers, old PC computers, you know, looking at these statistical projections. And essentially the statistical model broke down for a variety of reasons that are very complicated, but they made a wrong call. They fed it to the networks. The networks went with this wrong call. Then they pulled it back a couple of hours later. They made a second call at, you know, deep into the night, early morning of the Wednesday, the day following the election, and said, George W. Bush is the president of the United States. So I, along with many other people, watched that and said, oh, I guess Bush is the president, turned off our TVs, went to bed. And of course, because this was before, you know, iPhones and people getting buzzing messaging alerts about news events, you know, happening, went to bed, blissfully slept for, you know, 6 or 7 hours, woke up in the morning. I remember wake up in the morning, turning on the TV and saying, what the heck happened? It turns out that afterwards, they discovered they made a second mistake. They pulled back the projection of for George W. Bush and said, we don't know who won this election. And that's how it went into to the next day and the next 36 days, where basically you had two candidates who were fighting over, you know, 500 and some votes, enough votes, basically like a margin that's like the number of people that could fit into like a fairly, you know, small sized elementary school auditorium, you know, ended up deciding this election. And so the two candidates fought, you know, in a way that like, and now sort of has been repeated as farce, you know, the idea of like, well, you know, there could be balloting problems or irregularities. I mean, in Donald Trump's case in the 2020 election, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of votes, of like, you know, chances of like any like little miss, any sort of one small mistake having a determinative effect is like, you know, not possible. But in the case of the Florida election, it was so close that even these little teeny tiny issues like the design of a ballot in Palm Beach County, as you referred to earlier, that resulted in a lot of people mistakenly voting for Pat Buchanan when they meant to vote for Al Gore.
My Aunt Ruth. My Aunt Ruth is one.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay.
You
well,
can't talk to her anymore, but she is one. She was
yeah,
one.
I mean, I think a lot of those, I think a lot of those individuals who made that mistake are no longer with us, because they were largely, I think, elderly folks who lived in Palm Beach retirement communities, a lot of them Jewish. So the irony, of course, with Pat Buchanan was a, you know, reputedly anti-Semitic candidate that they ended up voting for. You know, anti-Semitic to the point that none other than Donald Trump had called him a Hitler lover in the campaign. So you have the bubbies of Palm Beach County That's voting correct. For the Hitler lover. And so it was like, you know, this incredible, you know, weird head scratching moment where it wasn't clear who won the presidential election, or even if it was possible to say who had won the presidential election, whether, you know, Al Gore sort of meditated on this idea during this time period of chaos theory, you know, the idea that, you know, like a teeny tiny fractal, ripple in the universe could create these gigantic downstream effects. This was actually sort of an illustration of that theory in real life. These tiny little decisions made by regular people, oftentimes, you know, well-intentioned regular people, you know, trying to do their best as like election bureaucrats, ended up having these gigantic effects on American history. Ultimately, Bush v. Gore was decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, which came down with a decision saying, no, we're going to stop counting. We're going to stop looking at these ballots. George W. Bush is the president by this margin of 537 votes, which is a fairly arbitrarily determined margin. Bush is the next president. Gore conceded, and this is a notable difference between yesterday's, you know, political culture and today's. Although Gore had a very good case to make that, you know, that a fair count would have made him the legitimate president. He conceded the election. He said, you know, we have elections in this country. We only have one president at a time. And, you know, George W. Bush is the next president. Thereby did, I think, a great service to the country. Even Republicans will, you know, I think will admit that. So that was really like the turning point in American politics. A lot of people never really accepted the legitimacy of George W. Bush, even though Al Gore had conceded the election.
And then he also makes really big decisions that are clearly divergent from what Al Gore would have pushed for. I mean, the tax cuts and the Iraq war and things like that. I mean, those became big problems. I mean, you look at the national debt now, it's at $31 trillion. It was not headed in that direction when they left office, right?
Yeah, they had when the big campaign issue between Bush and Gore was how to spend this surplus of several trillion dollars that, you know, was just this unanticipated, you know, undreamt of boon that came to the federal government. But back to your point about, you know, about how things were different with Bush as president, you know, if you want to think about it as a 1-2 punch, the second, of course, punch in the 1-2 punch was 9/11, that these individuals who were in Florida at the time, you know, of the election on September 11th mounted successfully their attack on the World Trade Center. The first point of impact actually happened to be the very place that the Voting News Service had its election night headquarters, where they made the incorrect projections of the election in an eerie coincidence.
That was shocking.
Yeah. And so ultimately, this is the first event, the election and the recount, you know, was determinative in the sense that it made George W. Bush president. But 9/11 was the event that made George W. Bush the president that he was. You know, I think there's a good argument to be made that George W. Bush had 9/11 not happened, would have been a very different kind of president. He certainly campaigned as a very different kind of candidate You know, his hallmark was compassionate conservatism. He, you know, didn't really talk very much about foreign policy, terrorism, or any of these issues, which he considered to be kind of not top of mind at the moment, and correctly assessed the American people's appetite for foreign intervention as being low. His main goal really at that time was to kind of create a new form of conservatism. Just to get an idea of what his form of conservatism looked like, you know, one of his major initiatives that he was pushing right prior to 2001, September 11th, 2001, it was going to be the next thing that was going to come up in the fall, was immigration reform. He famously said that, you know, compassion or love doesn't stop at the Rio Grande. He would speak in Spanish to audiences, and he talked very much about wanting to build a kind of a multiracial coalition within the Republican Party, bringing in Hispanic voters. So just a very, very different kind of Republican Party than what today's Republican Party is.
And one of the things you argue is that there were missed opportunities to get in the way of some of these currents that really developed in 2000, and particularly with 9/11. I mean, during the run-up to 9/11, one of the plotters was sort of he sort of had to back away from things, and the other 19 had to go kind of go for it. How did the 9/11 plot come out of the year 2000 and headed into 2001? Where did things stand, and how did they evade capture and, you know, remain undetected by our security services?
Well, so just wanted, like, you know, to make one point about, you know, how it came out of 2000. You know, I'll get to like the actual blow by blow of it in a second. But one way in which it came out of 2000 in a more thematic way is that, as I demonstrated in the book, you know, the factors that were motivating the people who committed the atrocity, the people who joined Osama bin Laden in Kandahar, Afghanistan, in late 1999, and ultimately became the plotters, were similar things to what Pat Buchanan and others were talking about. They were anti-globalists. They were conspiracy theorists. They were religiously motivated, yes, but they were also motivated by this idea that American power was illegitimate, and that globalization and the kind of like American, to use an academic-y term, like hegemony, was illegitimate and or even evil. This was something where they actually were drawing from anti-globalization, far right and far left ideologues as part of the foundational stuff. So to get to like how, so that was how it kind of came out of like this late 90s, early 2000s era, like how these people started off in 2000, 2001, by roughly the end of 2000, the four pilots who ultimately piloted their planes into the targets, or in Ziad Jarrah's case, into you know, was overwhelmed by a rebellion in the cockpit or in the plane, and ultimately crashed short of his target, which was the U.S. Capitol. By early 2000, the flight training portion of the plot, which is mostly what I describe, was over. They started bringing what were referred to later as the muscle hijackers over gradually and preparing for the actual attack. During this time period, actually, this was the kind of most dangerous point for the plotters. This was the point at which they became most exposed. When they were taking flight lessons in Florida, you know, none of them really did anything that was, you know, all that out of the ordinary. They were living very ordinary lives in Florida, and yeah, they seemed a little bit eccentric in different ways, but, you know, nothing really distinguished them from any of the many, many, many other foreign flight students that were in Florida. But come 2000, they started bringing more people into the country. A lot of them were less sophisticated. You know, they started having, you know, one of the pilots, as you mentioned, started having second thoughts. He wanted to perhaps drop out of the plot. He went back to Germany, which caused them to have to activate, seemingly caused them to have to activate this other operative named Zacharias Moussaoui, who was less skilled and almost instantaneously ended up getting picked up by the immigration INS at the time, and put in prison. FBI identified this individual as a probable terrorist sympathizer, at least, and was kind of sitting on him from late August until September 11th, kind of trying to decide what to do and whether to get a warrant to search his computer, which seems crazy now. But at the time,
yeah, they wouldn't have any trouble getting that warrant today.
Yeah, at the time there were a lot of regulations so basically what ended up happening was that there were all these moments at which the plot could have been disrupted, and the CIA and other organizations did a lot of like retrospection about this. Why how do we miss these signals? How do we not catch these guys before they acted? And I think the conclusion I drew was twofold. One was, they got really, really lucky that the plotters, I mean, so many things had to go right in order for this harebrained scheme to actually work. And the simplicity of, the kind of brilliance of it was like in its like unthinkable simplicity. But again, a lot of things were out of their control and fell their way. The other thing is that there's a decreased level of vigilance, I think at the federal law enforcement level, a lot of it having to do with the transition from one administration to another. The George W. Bush administration had de-emphasized terrorism relative to other foreign policy priorities, if not de-emphasized, they were sort of like less attuned to all the dangers, because the Clinton people had been watching this happen for 8 years and had been very, very engaged in trying to stop terrorist plots from happening again. When a lot of these people left, they were replaced by other people who just didn't have that same kind of background or same kind of mindset. And as a result, there was like this lull in vigilance that I think it's, fairly, we can't know what would have happened if Al Gore had been president, but we can know that, that he was somebody who was intimately involved in the Clinton administration's anti-terrorism policies. He was, a person who was deeply, deeply involved in things like the experimental predator drone program, and somebody who would have needed no real world lesson in why it would be necessary to be extremely vigilant about these sorts of threats. So at least we can say that Al Gore certainly wouldn't have been taken by surprise had something like this happened.
What other years did you think at all about? What other years could be viewed on par with the year 2000? Two of them that hit me were 1968 and 1865, but at least at first glance, it appears they're few and far between.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there you can sort of stick a pin at any point in the historical narrative and find interesting threads there. I think 1968 is clearly one that that people look at now and as a year in which so many things were happening. I mean, that was also a presidential election year, right? So oftentimes I think, when we think about formative years, they often are these years when there's a change in government in the United States, at least. But of course, 1968, there was worldwide turmoil. I think that the ones that you can think of are fairly obvious. I mean, 1914, 1789, 1848,
yeah, right.
you know, there are these moments of like sort of that serve as historical inflection points. And I would argue that 2000, you know, the 2000 hasn't been previously considered in that category. So it's not so much a question of, I think we all know, you know, what the big landmark years are. You know, what my book argues, what the year that broke America argues, is that the 2000 should be considered in that category.
When were the good old days?
Well, even in 2000, I think people, like, you know, were complaining about the loss of American power, you know, or that things were slightly better, you know, at some other juncture in history. I mean, I think, you know, I think there is a tendency to always kind of look back fondly, you know, sometime, you know, I was 25 in the year 1999. So maybe like everybody remembers the year that they were 25 as like, you know, great year.
Right.
But I do think that objectively there was a lot going right at that time in terms of just like where things were in the world. Bill Clinton, in his speeches, if you go back and read the speeches that he was delivering around the time of the millennium, I mean, so much of it is really about, you know, talking about how we're at the cusp of something wonderful here. The world has never been as at peace as it is today. We've never had such boundless prosperity. It was a time in which the internet was new and people thought the internet was going to be great. They didn't know what the internet was going to be.
It was going to be awful. Worst thing ever.
There was a general. I mean, it was the year that the Human Genome Project was completed,
right,
unlocking all these mysteries of human life that previously were unknown. It was a time in which like people were connected more than ever before, and that seemed novel, and we weren't as fixated on what the downsides of that were. And it was a time when, you know, radical organizations of all sorts, whether it be radical terrorist organizations in the Middle East, radical political organizations inside the United States, all of these organizations were, all of these kinds of ideas were somewhat banished to the fringes, you know, and nobody really wanted to nobody really wanted to talk about politics in a way, because politics just didn't seem all that important. So maybe like a lesson to draw from all of this is that politics only seem important when politics seem to be falling apart.
How's the magazine business? What are you working on at New York Magazine?
Oh, talking about apocalypse.
Yeah, right. I didn't mean to connect it to.
No, things are good. I mean, New York is a great place to explore stories like the ones that, you know, are in my book. Some of the material in my book grew out of work that I was doing as a journalist there. Actually, the book sort of started when I was writing a profile of this attorney, David Boies, who subsequently went on to some fame in 2000 as the lead attorney for Gore and Bush v. Gore, and then went on to some infamy in subsequent years as an attorney for Harvey Weinstein, who he met while contesting the 2000 election for Al Gore. And so, you know, that was like sort of the initial little kernel or confluence that caused me to start thinking about writing this book. Many of these individuals on the cover of this book that you noted, which your podcast listeners can't see, but it will look very good, especially if you happen to look it up on Amazon.com right now. The Year That Broke America.
Yeah,
it's a great cover.
Amazing. Yeah.
But it's a bunch of different personalities and personages, many of whom I discovered or first encountered as a journalist for New York Magazine and elsewhere. So I say that this book started off as journalism and ended up as history, And I think that's what good journalism is. You know, they say it's the rough first draft of history, but if you get it right, maybe it's not as rough as maybe it doesn't need as many revisions as you
Are you
might.
able to say what you're working on right now?
I've been working actually on a series of articles involving what you might describe as information warfare. My most recent article was a cover story that had to do with you basically covered this controversy over Hunter Biden's laptop, which if you're on the right or watch Fox News, you know all about. If you aren't, you might not know all the details, or you might only have a very fuzzy idea of why people are talking about Hunter Biden's laptop. But my story, our cover story that I did with Olivia Nuzzi, one of my colleagues, is it's meant to serve as a kind of explainer for why the laptop is important and what, if anything, the stuff on it means.
Andrew Rice, the author of The Year That Broke America, An Immigration Crisis, A Terrorist Conspiracy, The Summer of Survivor, A Ridiculous Fake Billionaire, A Fight for Florida, and The 537 Votes That Changed Everything. Thanks so much for being here.
All right. Thank you so much.
Check out the book. Check out his website, andrewrice.net. He's on Twitter at RiceID. I want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping the show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity for children's literacy. And thank you for listening to Axel Bank Reports, History and Today, conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Axel Bank History. We update those with clips from the show, guest announcements, and book recommendations. We'll see you next time. Thanks.